Drawing on Jesus' words at the end of Matthew's gospel, where he told the disciples to go and make disciples of all nations, and that he would be with them till the end of the age, the 5th century church father Jerome wrote, quote, "Jesus was present in all places, with Thomas in India, with Peter in Rome, with Paul in Illyria, with Titus in Crete, with Andrew in Greece, with each apostle in his own separate region," unquote. Now, so far, we've followed the track of most Western reviews of church history, both secular and religious, by concentrating on what took place in the West and Roman Empire. We've delved somewhat into the Eastern Roman Empire, which continued to think of itself as the Roman Empire long after the West had disintegrated in the 5th century. It was only later that it was referred to as the Byzantine Empire. In recent episodes, we've seen the focus of attention shift to the East, where the Christological controversies of the 4th and 5th centuries took place. In this episode, we're going to stay in the East and follow the track of the expansion of the faith as it moved eastward. This is simply an amazing chapter that's often neglected in traditional treatments of church history. It's well captured by Philip Jenkins in his book, The Lost History of Christianity. We start all the way back at the beginning with the Apostle Thomas. He's linked by fairly solid tradition to the spread of Christianity into the East. In the quote that we started with from the early 5th century church father Jerome, we learn that the Apostle Thomas carried the gospel east all the way to India. Now, in the early 4th century, Eusebius also attributed the expansion of the faith in India to Thomas. Though these traditions do face some dispute, there are still so-called Thomas Christians in southern Indian state of Kerala today. They use an Aramaic form of worship that, well, it had to have been transported there very early. A tomb and shrine in honor of Thomas at Mylapore is built of bricks that were used by a Roman trading colony, but abandoned after AD 50. There's abundant evidence of several Roman trading colonies along the coast of India with hundreds of first century coins and ample evidence of Jewish communities there. Jews were known to be a major part of Roman trade ventures. Their communities were prime stopping places for the efforts of Christian missionaries, as they followed the Apostle Paul's model, as we find described for us in the book of Acts. A song commemorating Thomas's role in bringing the faith to India wasn't committed to writing until 1601, but was said to have been passed on in Kerala for 50 generations. Many trading vessels sailed to India in the first century when the secret of the monsoon winds was finally discovered, and so it's quite possible that Thomas did indeed make that journey. Once the monsoons were finally figured out, over 100 trade ships a year crossed from the Red Sea to India. Now, Jesus told the disciples to take the gospel to the ends of the earth, and while they were slow to catch on to the need to leave Jerusalem, persecution eventually convinced them to, well, get moving. It's not hard to imagine Thomas considering a voyage to India as a way to literally fulfill the command of Christ. India would have seemed the end of the earth. Thomas's work in India began in the northwest region of the country. A 4th century work called the Acts of Thomas says that he led a ruler there named Gundafor to the faith. That story had been pretty much rejected by most scholars until an inscription was discovered in 1890 along with some coins which verify the 20-year reign in the 1st century of a king, Gundafor. Now, after planting the church in the north, Thomas traveled by ship to the Malabar coast in the south. He planted several churches, mainly along the Payer River. He preached to all classes of people and had about 17,000 converts from all Indian castes. Stone crosses were erected at places where churches were founded, which became centers of pilgrimage. Thomas was careful to appoint local leadership for the churches that he founded. He then traveled overland to the southern eastern Indian coast and the area of Madras. Another local king and many of his subjects were converted. But the Brahmins, that is the highest of the Indian castes, were concerned that the gospel would undermine a cultural system that was to their advantage, and so they convinced the king at Mylapore to arrest and interrogate Thomas. He was sentenced to death and executed in AD 72. The church in that area then came under persecution, and many Christians fled for refuge to Kerala. About 100 years later, according to both Eusebius and Jerome, a theologian from the great school at Alexandria named Antoninus, traveled to India to preach Christ to the Brahmins. Now, serving to confirm Thomas's work in India is the writing of Bardaisan. At the opening of the 3rd century, he spoke of entire tribes who were following Jesus in North India who claimed to have been converted by Thomas, the apostle. They had numerous books and relics to prove it. By AD 226, there were bishops of the church in the East in Northwest India, Afghanistan, and Balochistan, with thousands of laymen and clergy engaging in missionary activity. Such a well-established Christian community means the presence of the faith there for the previous several decades at least. The first church historian, Eusebius of Caesarea, to whom we owe so much of our information about the early church, attributed to Thomas the spread of the gospel to the East. As those familiar with the history of the Roman Empire know, the Romans faced continuous grief from the East by one Persian group after another. Their contest with the Parthians and Sassanids is a thing of legend. The buffer zone between the Romans and the Persians was called Osrene, with its capital city of Edessa located at the border of what today is northern Syria and eastern Turkey. Now, according to Eusebius, Thomas received a request from Agbar, the king of Edessa, for healing, and Thomas responded by sending Thaddeus, one of the disciples mentioned in Luke chapter 10. Thus, the gospel took root there. There was a sizable Jewish community in Edessa from which the gospel made several converts. Word got back to Israel of the church community growing in the city, and when persecution broke out in the Roman Empire, many refugees made their way east to settle in a place that now welcomed them. So Edessa became a center of Syrian-speaking church activity, which began sending missionaries east into Mesopotamia, north into Persia, Central Asia, and then even further eastward. The missionary Mari managed to plant a church in the glorious Persian capital of Ctesiphon, located just north of the ancient site of Babylon, which became a center of missionary outreach in its own right. Then, by the late 2nd century, Christianity had spread throughout Media, Persia, Parthia, and Bactria. The 24 bishops who oversaw the region carried out their ministry more as itinerant missionaries than by, staying in a single city and church. They were what we would refer to as tent makers, earning their way as merchants and craftsmen as they shared the faith wherever they went. By 280, the churches of Mesopotamia and Persia adopted the title of Catholic to acknowledge their unity with the Western Church during the last days of the persecution by the Roman emperors. Then, in 424, the Mesopotamian Church held a council at the city of Ctesiphon, where they elected their first lead bishop to have jurisdiction over the whole church of the East, including India and Ceylon, known today as Sri Lanka. Ctesiphon was an important point on the East-West trade routes, which extended to India, China, Java, and all the way to Japan. The shift of ecclesiastical authority was away from Edessa, which in 216 became a tributary of Rome. The establishment of an independent patriarchate contributed to a more favorable attitude by the Persians, who were no longer fearful of an alliance with the hated Romans. Now, to the northwest of Persia was the ancient kingdom of Armenia, which had been a political football between the Persians and the Romans for generations. Both the Persians and the Romans used Armenia as a kind of place to try out new diplomatic maneuvers with each other. The poor Armenians just wanted to be left alone, but that was not to be, given their location between these two superpowers, these two empires. Armenia has the historical distinction of being the first state to embrace Christianity as a national religion, even before the conversion of Constantine the Great in the early 4th century. Now, the one who brought the gospel to Armenia was a member of the royal family named Gregory, called later the Illuminator. While still a boy, Gregory's family was exiled from Armenia to Cappadocia when his father was thought to have been part of a plot to assassinate the king of Armenia. As a grown man who had become a Christian, Gregory returned home, where he shared the faith with King Tiridates, who ruled at the dawn of the 4th century. Now, Tiridates was converted, and Gregory's son succeeded him as bishop of the new Armenian church. This son attended the Council of Nicaea in 325. Armenian Christianity has remained a distinctive and important brand of the faith, with 5 million still professing allegiance to the Armenian Church. Though persecution came to an official end in the Roman Empire with Constantine's Edict of Toleration in 313, it began for the church in Persia in 340. And the primary cause for persecution was political. When Rome became Christian, its old enemy turned anti-Christian. You know, up to that point, the situation had been reversed. For the first 300 years, it was the Western Christians who were persecuted, and Persia was a refuge for them. The Persians were religiously tolerant, while their less tolerant Sassanid successors were too busy fighting Rome to waste time or effort on the Christians who lived among them. But in 315, a letter from Constantine to his Persian counterpart, Shapur II, triggered the beginnings of an ominous change in the Persian attitude towards the Christians. Constantine believed that he was writing to help his fellow believers in Persia, but succeeded only in exposing them. He wrote to the young Persian ruler, quote, "I rejoice to hear that the fairest provinces of Persia are adorned with Christians. Since you are so powerful and pious, I commend them to your care and leave them in your protection," unquote. Well, the schemes and intrigues that had flowed for generations between Rome and the Parthians, and then their successors, the Sassanids, were so intense that the letter moved Shapur to become suspicious that the Christians were a kind of fifth column, working from inside the Persian Empire to bring the Sassanids down. Any doubts about that were dispelled 20 years later when Constantine gathered his forces in the east for war. And Eusebius says that Roman bishops accompanied the army into battle. To make matters worse, in Persia, one of their own preachers predicted that Rome would defeat the Sassanids. Little wonder then, when persecution began shortly after that, the first accusation brought against the Christians was that they aided the enemy, the Romans. Shapur ordered a double taxation on Christians and held their bishop responsible for collecting it. Shapur knew that Christians tended to be poor, since so many had come from the West fleeing persecution in the Roman Empire, and so the bishop would be hard-pressed to come up with the money. But Bishop Simon refused to be intimidated. He declared the tax unjust and said, "I'm no tax collector, I'm a shepherd of the Lord's flock." Shapur counter-declared that the church was now in rebellion, and the killings began. A second decree ordered the destruction of churches and the execution of clergy who refused to participate in the official Sassanid-sponsored sun worship. Bishop Simon was seized and brought before Shapur. Offered a huge bribe to capitulate, he refused. The Sassanids promised that if he alone would renounce Christ, the rest of the Christian community wouldn't be harmed, but that if he refused, he would be condemning all Christians to destruction. And when the Christians heard of that, they rose up, protesting en masse that this was shameful. And so Bishop Simon and a large number of the clergy were executed. For the next 20 years, Christians were hounded from one end of Persia to the other. At times, it was general massacre. Most often, it was just targeted at the church leaders. Then, another form of suppression was the search for that part of the Christian community that was most vulnerable to persecution, and that was Persians who had converted from the native Zoroastrianism. The faith spread first among non-Persians in the population, especially Jews and Syrians. But by the beginning of the 4th century, Persians, in increasing numbers, were attracted to the Christian faith. For such converts, church membership often meant the loss of everything: family, property rights, even their lives. But it was the martyrdom of Bishop Simon and the years of persecution that followed that gutted the Persian church of its leadership and its organization. As soon as the Christians of Ctesiphon would elect a new bishop, he would be seized and killed. Adding to the anti-Roman motivation of the government's role in the persecutions was a deep undercurrent of Zoroastrian fanaticism that came as a result of the conversion of so many of their number to the new faith of Christianity. It was a shocking example of religious envy. Now, shortly before Shapur II's death in 379, persecution slackened. It had lasted for about 40 years and only ended with his death. When at last the suffering ceased, it's estimated that close to 200,000 Persian Christians had been put to death. So, by the dawn of the 6th century, there were three main branches of the Christian church. the Church of the West, which of course looked to Rome and Constantinople for leadership. Then there was the Church of Africa, with its great center at Alexandria and an emerging center in Ethiopia at that time. And then there was the Church of the East, with its center first in Syria and then in Persia. Now, the Church of the East was launched in Edessa at the border between northern Syria and eastern Turkey, as I said. But as the Church of the East moved even further east, the theological school that was based in Edessa transferred to Nisibis in eastern Turkey in 471. It was led by the brilliant theologian Narsai. This school had 1,000 students who went out from there to lead the churches of the East. Several mercenary endeavors were also launched from Nisibis, just as Iona was a sending base for Celtic Christianity in the far northwest, something that we'll turn to in a future episode. The Eastern Church mounted successful missions among the nomadic people of the Middle East and Central Asia between the mid-5th through the 7th centuries. These included church planting efforts among the Huns. Abraham of Kaskar, who lived during the 6th century, did much to plant monastic communities throughout the East. During the first 1,200 years, the Church of the East grew both geographically and numerically far more than in the West. The primary reason for this was that in the East, missionary work was largely a movement of the laity. As Europe moved into the Middle Ages with its strict feudal system, travel came to a virtual standstill. Well, in the East, trade and commerce grew. This resulted in the movement of increasing numbers of people who carried the faith with them wherever they went. When the Sassanids began the great persecution of Christians in Persia, that sent large numbers of the faithful south and then even further east. Following the persecution that came under Shapur II, another, far more severe round of persecution broke out in the mid-5th century, that saw 10 bishops and some 153,000 Christians massacred in just a few days. Now, when we think of Arabia, many immediately think of Islam. But Christianity had taken root in the peninsula long before Muhammad came on the scene. A bishop from Qatar was present at the Council of Nicaea in 325. The Arabian queen Maria, whose forces defeated the Romans in 373, insisted on receiving an Orthodox bishop before she would make peace with the Romans. There was mission outreach to the southeastern region of Arabia, in what is today Yemen, before the birth of Muhammad. By the opening of the 6th century, there were dozens of churches all along the Arabian shore of the Persian Gulf. The rise of Islam in the 7th century was to have far-reaching consequences for the church in the East. The Persian capital at Ctesiphon fell to the Arabs in just 637. Since the church there had become a kind of Rome to the Church of the East, the impact was massive. Muslims were sometimes tolerant of religious minorities, but only as communities of the disenfranchised known as the Dhimmi. They became ghettos stripped of vitality. At the same time, the Church of the East was being shredded by Muslim conquerors. It was taking one of its biggest steps forward by reaching into China in the mid-7th century. While the Church of the West grew mostly by the work of trained clergy and the missionary monks of Celtic Christianity, in the East, as often as not, it was Christian merchants and craftsmen who advanced the faith. The Church of the East placed great emphasis on education and literacy. It was understood that being a follower of Jesus meant an education that included reading, writing, and theology. An educated laity meant an abundance of workers who were capable of spreading the faith, and spread it they did. Christians often found employment among less advanced people, serving in government offices and teachers and secretaries. They helped solve the problem of illiteracy by inventing simplified alphabets based on the Syriac language, which framed their own literature and theology. And while that was at first a boon, in the end it proved a hindrance. You see, those early missionaries failed to understand the principle of contextualization, that the gospel is supercultural, that it transcends things like language and traditions. Those early missionaries who pressed rapidly into the East assumed that their Syrian version of the faith was the only version, and they tried to convert those that they met to that. And so as a consequence, while a few did accept the faith and learned Syrian Aramaic, A few generations later, the old religions and languages reasserted themselves, and Christianity was either swept away or so assimilated into the culture that it wasn't really a biblically faithful expression of the faith any longer. The golden age of early missions in Central Asia was from the end of the 4th century to the later part of the 9th. And then both Islam and Buddhism came on the scene. Northeast of Persia, the church had an early and extensive period around the Oxus River, today known as the Amudarya. By the early 4th century, the cities of Merv, Herat, and Samarkand had bishops. Once the faith was established in that region, it spread quickly further east into the basin of the Tarim River, and then into the area north of the Tian Shan Mountains and Tibet. It spread along this path because that was the premier caravan route. With so many Christians engaged in trade, it was natural that the gospel was soon planted in these caravan centers. In the 11th century, the faith began to spread among the nomadic peoples of the Central Asian regions. These Christians were mostly from the Tartars and the Mongol tribes of the Kharyats, Ungers, Uyghurs, Naimans, and Merkits. Now, it's not clear exactly when Christianity reached Tibet, but it most likely arrived there by the 6th century. The territory of the ancient Tibetans stretched further west and north than the present-day nation, and they had extensive contact with the nomadic tribes of Central Asia. A vibrant church existed in Tibet by the 8th century. The patriarch of the Assyrian church in Mesopotamia, Timothy I, wrote from Baghdad in 782 that the Christian community in Tibet was one of the largest groups under his oversight. He appointed a Tibetan patriarch to oversee the many churches there. The center of the Tibetan church was located in Lhasa, and the church thrived there until the late 13th century when Buddhism swept through the region. An inscription carved into a large boulder at the entrance to the Pass of Tangsi, once part of Tibet but now in India, has three crosses and some writing indicating the presence of the Christian faith there. The pass was one of the main ancient trade routes between Lhasa and Bactria. The crosses are stylistically from the Church of the East, and one of the words appears to be Jesus. Another inscription reads, quote, "In the year 210 came Nasfarn from Samarkand as emissary to the Khan of Tibet," unquote. Now, that might not seem like a reference to Christianity until you take a closer look at the date, 210. That only makes sense in reference to measuring time since the birth of Christ, which was already a practice in the church. Now, this aforementioned Timothy I became patriarch of the Assyrian church about 780. His church was in the ancient Mesopotamian city of Seleucia, the larger twin of the Persian capital of Ctesiphon. He was 52 and well past the average age expectancy for people of that time. Timothy lived into his 90s, dying in 823. During his long life, he devoted himself to spiritual conquest as energetically as Alexander the Great had to the military kind. While Alexander built an earthly empire, Timothy sought to expand the kingdom of God. At every point, Timothy's career smashes everything that we think that we know about the history of Christianity at that time. He alters ideas about the geographical spread of the faith, its relationship with political power, its cultural influence, and its interaction with other religions. In terms of his prestige and the geographical extent of his authority, Timothy was the most significant Christian leader of his day, far more influential than the Pope in Rome or the Patriarch in Constantinople. A quarter of the world's Christians looked to him as both a spiritual and political head. Now, no responsible historian of Christianity would leave out Europe. Omitting Asia from the record is just as unthinkable. We can't understand Christian history without Asia or Asian history without Christianity. Now, the Church of the East cared little for European developments. Timothy I certainly knew about his European contemporary Charlemagne. The Frankish ruler had engaged in diplomatic missions with the Muslim Caliphate, a development of which the leader of the Church of the East would have been apprised. Timothy also knew that Rome had its own leader called the Pope. He was certainly aware of the tension between the Pope and the Patriarch of Constantinople over who was the de facto leader of the Christian world. And Timothy probably thought their squabble was silly. I mean, wasn't it obvious that the Church of the East was heir to the primitive church, the first church? If Rome drew its authority from Peter, Mesopotamia looked to Christ himself, After all, Jesus was a descendant of that ancient Mesopotamian, Abraham. And wasn't Mesopotamia the original source of culture and civilization, not to mention the location of the Garden of Eden? It was the East, rather than the West, that first embraced the gospel. The natural home of Christianity was in Mesopotamia and points east. According to the geographical wisdom of that time, Seleucia stood on the center of the world's routes of trade and communication, equally placed between the civilizations that looked respectively to the west and then to the east. Now, all over the lands of modern-day Iraq and Iran, believers built huge and enduring churches. Because of its setting close to the Roman frontier, but far enough beyond to avoid interference, Mesopotamia retained a powerful Christian culture that lasted through the 13th century. Throughout the European Middle Ages, and the Mesopotamian church was as much a cultural and spiritual Christian headquarters as France or Germany, or even that outstanding missionary base of Ireland. Several Mesopotamian cities like Basra, Mosul, Kirkuk, and Tikrit were thriving centers of Christianity for centuries after the arrival of Islam. In 800 AD, these churches and the schools attached to them were responsible for the classical scholarship of the Greeks, Romans, and Persians that Western Europe would not access for another 400 years. Simply put, there was no dark age in the Church of the East. From Timothy I's perspective, the culture and scholarship of the ancient world was never lost. And more importantly, the Church of the East countenanced no break between the primitive church that rose in Jerusalem in the book of Acts and themselves. Now, consider this. You know, we can easily contrast the Latin-speaking feudal world of the European Middle Ages with the ancient Middle Eastern church rooted in a Greek and Aramaic-speaking culture. The medieval church of Europe saw itself as pretty far removed from the early church. Both in language and thought forms, they were culturally distinct and distant. But in Timothy I's time, that is the early 9th century, the Church of the East still spoke Greek and Aramaic. Its members shared the same basic Middle Eastern culture and would continue to do so for centuries more. As late as the 13th, they still called themselves Nazarenes, a title the first Christians had used. They called Jesus Yeshua. Clergy were given the title Rabban, meaning teacher or master. It's related to the Hebrew word rabbi. Eastern theologians used the same literary style as the authors of the Jewish Talmud, rather than the theological works of Western Europe. As Philip Jenkins says, if we ever wanted to speculate on what the early church might have looked like if it had developed while avoiding its alliance with Roman state power, we have but to look to the East. Repeatedly, we find Patriarch Timothy I referring to the fact that the churches of the East used texts that were lost and forgotten in the West. Because of their close proximity to the setting of so much of Jewish and early Christian history, Eastern scholars had abundant access to ancient scriptures and texts. One hint of what was available comes from one of Timothy's letters. Now, written in 800, Timothy answered the questions of a Jew who was in the process of converting to Christianity. This Jew told the patriarch of the recent finding of a large hoard of ancient manuscripts, both biblical and apocryphal, in a cave near Jericho. The documents had been acquired by Jerusalem's Jewish community. Now, without much doubt, this was an early find of what would later come to be known as the Dead Sea Scrolls. And thank God this early find didn't move treasure hunters to ransack other caves of the area. Well, in any case, as now, scholars were thrilled at that discovery. Timothy then responded with appropriate questions. He wanted to know what light the find might shed on some passages of scripture that he was curious about. He was eager to discover how the newfound texts compared with the known Hebrew versions of the Old Testament. You know, how did they compare with the Greek Septuagint? Timothy was delighted to hear back that the passages that he was concerned about did indeed exist in the ancient manuscripts that had been discovered. Timothy's questions are impressive when we compare them to what Western Latin scholars would have made of such a find. They had no idea of the issues that Timothy raised. They could not have even read the language or the ancient manuscripts. Only a handful of Western scholars would even have known how to hold the manuscripts, for instance, which was, you know, which way was up, and how do you read them, from left to right or right to left? The church of the East that Timothy I led was devoted to both scholarship and missionary activity. While the Latin church saw the Atlantic Ocean as a wall that blocked expansion to the West, the church of the East saw Asia as a vast region just waiting to be evangelized. The Eastern church was divided into regions known as metropolitans. And so the term metropolitan was then used for the church leader of that region, much like an archbishop, under whom were several bishops, to whom a number of priests and their churches then reported. Now, to give you an idea of how vast the Church of the East was, Timothy had 19 metropolitans and 85 bishops who reported to him. In the West, England had 2 archbishops. During Timothy's tenure as patriarch, 5 new metropolitan sees were created near Tehran in Syria, Turkestan, Armenia, and 1 on the Caspian Sea. Arabia had at least 4 bishops, and Timothy ordained a new one in Yemen. Timothy I was to the Church of the East what Gregory I had been to the Western Church in terms of missionary zeal. He commissioned monks to carry the faith from the Caspian Sea all the way to China. He reported the conversion of the great Khagan who ruled most of Central Asia.